logic you are still not going to get, I'm afraid. This is an incredibly difficult sequence of acts to follow. I feel, after the wonderful songs we've just heard, very much in the presence not only of a beautiful living voice, but also voices of the dead. And I feel a little bit like another recently dead poet, Philip Larkin. This is not that I feel particularly moribund myself, but my fellow countryman Philip Larkin, who would have been, I believe, the poet laureate in England, had he been perhaps less modest, he died this month. And in his church-going poem, which some of you may have read, he recalls that he feels surrounded, and he finds that a church is a serious place because so many dead lie around. And I know that Monsieur Soupeau is far from dead, and I'm imagining him now with his large ball of silver foil and remembering my own days as a smoker when I too smoked Gauloises cigarettes and fell in love with the particular blue of their packages. And this blue is what I associate with that particular adjective, or perhaps it's really a noun that is almost central to French symbolist poets. It's the French word azur, blue, sky blue, whatever it is, the blue yonder, the ultimate. And it's with this concept of Gauloises blue or azur that I'd like to begin. I too have tried to translate poetry, but I tried to translate the impossible and had very little success trying to translate the works of Mallarmé, a few poems by Mallarmé. But I have written a poem about that relationship that I had with a dead poet. It's called Arm Wrestling with Monsieur Mallarmé. And I'll begin with that. It begins in French, but you, I think most of you can figure this one out if you've had just a few years of French. Le 14 juillet, vers la fin du 20e siècle. It shouldn't be the end. It should be the beginning of the 20th century. Why have I put that there? I'm not sure. In our red union suits, we face off across the breakfast table. The tablecloth is as blue as the blue he and his kind called azur, and subsequently used to make cigarette packs. And the hands we keep cupped, palm down on the cloth, our left hands, ancien combattant, are as white as the white of porcelain and alabaster and the ancient bleached wood of funerary coffers that hold small, gnarled artifacts of blackened silver, whose functions, no doubt ritual, have been forgotten, perhaps irredeemably. Our right hands, meanwhile, are raised, poised like the blades of samurai swords, aimed to chop and to miss narrowly, whistling. This is all a manner of speaking. But if eyes could win tournaments, mine tangling with his would hoist him clear out of his seat and up through the roof. It too, the color of poetical cigarette packs, dangling him like a doll over the curved earth. And I would secure him there in the bed linen clean stratosphere, letting the filthy weather seethe and jostle 100,000 measures below. But all this he knows so well. As we lean in, putting our weight against the hard ball of air that keeps our palms and centuries apart. His reputation lending him no advantage. So my fingertips inch inwards, imperturbable, exploratory even in this well-traveled territory, until they meet his fingertips and, entering the looking glass, find once more the skin of icy sweat that clothes his skin. And then I shape, define, create the contours of his eyes, his nose, his brow, and enter again the soft cave of his mouth to touch the treasured syllables, azure, which demonstrates it's tough to translate from any language and I could never succeed. There's that one. Thoughts of the dead, melancholy thoughts. I'd like to begin, in fact, before getting on to, I don't know, rougher stuff, I'd like to begin with a couple of elegies. I didn't think of doing the first one until I heard the words, or at least the words I think in English, your words, from Supo, which reminded me of another surrealist, a Belgian, Michel de Gelderode. And I remembered working in a play with a young man who was one of my students, who unfortunately died of cancer at a very early age, in his early 20s. And the epigraph to this poem, I put it in English, is from de Gelderode's play, Night of Pity, simply, "Look now, it's raining kisses." And this poem is called "Running a Crooked Mile," and it's for Robert Valier. As I stumble out before dawn into the December street, Venus hangs in the red-smeared eastern sky, brilliant below the moon. The Star of Islam fumbled by a clumsy juggler, the Christmas star dropping like an egg from a godlike buttock's silvery curve. And as I begin my run, I think of you, the voice of the nocturnal vocalist, this very day, a decade ago, warning the soldier too cowardly to desert, warning the girl with her ragdoll baby, "In the street somewhere I have lost my heart, and now I'll hang myself, fair innocence." At the corner of Sylvester and Swan, where I breathe the dead smell of the house whose roof flowered into flames last week, the tail lights of a neighbor's car theatrically blinks in a baroque billow of fumes. To the tune of my breathing at the intersection of 10 years gone and 10 years hence, the moon and planet pale. The nocturnal vocalist observed the night, the revelry, the rape of an old world, and after 10 or 60 years, the news is still of bewildered soldiers and of native girls painted for war and whoring, is still a tale of burned and broken dolls. On lawn after lawn, last night's post-dispatch lies plastic wrap, unread. I see you now on the day of your early departure, high in the tree you climbed 10 years ago in wintry Missouri. At what incalculable cost you have reached that dizzying altitude. Yet, in despite of those huge stones which weight your belly. Your eyes illuminate your lovely skull's bright globe, seeing what we won't see. The Americas are crying, and you hear them cry. While fat and scant of breath, I run at dawn for dear life's sake to find my crooked sixpence and live in crooked style. From where you perch, so far beyond our reach, you smile to see a new but dark Pacific gleam below a shower of stars. The other elegy I'd like to read is for a good friend of mine who passed away this summer, his home in Vermont, and he used to live just around the corner here on Maryland, and was a colleague of mine. Some of you may know him. Some of you I know him. I'm talking about Russell Durgin. If I can find the poem. My wife Bonnie and I were very lucky to see Russell, who was a great, I won't call him an impresario, a sponsor of underground arts, if you want, street theater, that kind of thing, here in St. Louis in the 1960s and early 70s. And Bonnie and I visited him when he was very sick this summer in Vermont. This is called One Morning Like Many Others in Vermont, and it's in memoriam for Russell Franklin Durgin, 1924 to 1985. And it begins with an epigraph again, this one from the Irish playwright Sing. Then he went into his bed, and he was saying it was destroyed he was the time the shadow was going up through the glen. I am eating an apple picked from the very top of the tree, sweet, crisp, and the palest of green. My two boys race downhill, leaving in the deep yellow meadow grass a wake of breathless laughter. To his six-year-old godson, the master teacher, hunched under the painful sprouting of wings, offered a first and last lesson of fire building. 5, 6, pick up sticks, 7, 8, lay them straight. Then the terrifying matches hastily dropped, the boy so serious at the task. Now down they go, the boy and his brother, with years of meadows ahead of them, diminishing away from me, godless beside the apple tree, down and down to the blood-red farm, its roof of blazing metal, extinguished as the witless shadow of a cloud bruises the grass, filling the hollows where the deer have lain, numbing the morning so that laughter becomes a questionable memory. Did ever the deer nestle at night so close to walls where prayers of fire gushed out of hollow logs? Were there indeed but now two children echoing the laughter of so many snows ago? My good old friend says, eat the apples before they touch the ground. They spoil so soon. Their pale skins bruised by the same cruel dark that follows boys downhill and gives their cries of joy to others' mouths. Well, that's a melancholy note to sort of open on. And I'm going to change completely and throw something ridiculous at you, if you will. sometimes asked, you know, why don't you write in meter, you know, why do you write free verse? Well, I hope it's obvious, but I sometimes try to do something in meter. So here's an exercise then in blank verse. It's called The March of Scientific Progress. In 1892, two gentlemen, frock-coated and wing-coloured homme d'affaires, assisted by an Arab artisan, a wretch in butcher's bib and rubber boots, are going to electroplate a child. The child is dead, and yet assumes a pose, floating inside its jar, its bow-legged stance and dangling hands and heavy-lidded gaze, aping the slouching Arab. This event, intrepid venture to exploit the trend of petrifying baby shoes, occurs below the very boudoir where Madame, the spouse of one of these brave pioneers, is at this moment bordering on a swoon under the dusky hands of her masseur, son of a tribal king in Senegal, whose fingers ease into her cloudy skin, pure ambergris, obtained at great expense and risked sans doute to life and limb by those Nantucket whalers whose frail craft traversed the gulfs of southern oceans, as she sighs and moans and writhes a bit and says, too loud, "Pray do not stop, I give myself to you." Downstairs, the two morticians give the nod. The Arab nods reply and throws the switch. The baby fries. The lady turns to gold. Soupeau has a line somewhere which I read. He says, "Je souris parce que je suis ici." That means I'm smiling because I'm here, right? But back again, this is going to be a kind of uphill, downhill thing. I'm going to read you a poem whose title I'm not sure how to pronounce. People who teach, as I teach, say, tell the students, tragedy, the word comes from the Greek, it means goat song. I call this tragedia or tragoidia, however, we can say tragedy. And I think this maybe typifies the way in which I write. The thing that Michael was talking about actually was not my idea. I think it was, it's partly in the blurb in the front of my book, this thing about the different screens, the movie show thing. I tried to write stories, I suppose. And this one is a tragedy. It's a sort of classic tragedy. If it's comic, fine. I'm not sure. I think I don't remember if it was Samuel Beckett or Harold Pinter observed that tragedy was always comic, or that comedy was always tragic, whatever it is. This one then, tragedia. In her plum-colored stockings and her black skirt and shoes, she walks the length of the train. The only passengers are children and women. All are bared to the waist. She walks as if to bring herself sooner to the ocean, recalling the brown mist of the northern evening pushing against the panes. In the abandoned greenhouse, she sprawled face down amid the shattered plant pots in an ashy mess of dried loam and black geranium roots. He stood at the door. With all the men of the household, she felt his stare move like a razor from her black party slippers and ankle socks up the backs of her legs. In the windows of the train, there is nothing. Even when the blinds are raised, the light against the glass blazes in paper-blank monotone off the sea and shore. His voice smashed the door like a buckshot blast. At the halt, she crosses the bleached boards and gazes over the sand and the horizonless brassy water. The train trembles into a silence sustained by the rasp of grasshoppers in the bristling dunes. The sweat shivers down her backbone to her soaked waistband. She wipes the hair from her face. It is then that the goats come, their bleating, mimicking an event in her own hurt throat. She was wrapped in a dirty towel, unable to move. She rubbed a hole in the fog of the bathroom mirror and faced the white-lipped urchin, her hair filled with splintered glass. She was, at that moment, his only child. The goats, herded by lean outriders, lurch and stumble out of the white distance, bearded heads and twisted horns jerking, slack udders and bollocks swinging. She sat on the bed a long time with the cellophane packet in her hands. The new stockings, their color pleased her. To forgive her flaws had taken a long time. And when she drew the slithery plum skin up over her knee, its texture pleased her. Her breasts, their shape and weight, for the very first time, pleased her. When he came home to scrub the atrocity of the 10 years' war out of his paws, she fell upon him. Under the painted eyes of his GI bride, the bathtub filled with blood. The instant of passion when, in a landscape virtually uneventful, the fragmentary past returns with all its violences, reveals that forgiveness was long foregone. The goats are driven between her and the sea. Their stink and outcry follow them beyond the dunes. Now there is only the interminable train ride home. And while we are in the mood, or I'm in the mood, for classical allusions, here's an old one. I might even have read this years ago at Duff's. I think I even wrote it, well, before I came to this country, 17 years ago. Orpheus. Only the ragged edge esplanade, a cliff of mealy concrete, and 100 yards of snow-blotched beach separate the house front from the sluggish sea. Until 11 p.m., the sky is pinked with the dull sunset glow of the super bazaar, 2 blocks behind the congealing shade of the yellow-gray brick facade and the porch of frayed chinoiserie. Under the bruised sky, north of the wall, by a bridge that sags into a smoking river below a ridge of pine and crag, stallions with tasseled saddles swing their blunt heads. There are no footprints on the snowed-up porch, but someone's hand is turning the stiff crank and the slatted awning is squealing down. Under the neon glow, svelte limousines are swung in wild orbits while the lighthouse beam pauses and sweeps across the littered shore. I turn from the door. You are drifting from me. Seaward, beyond the tarpaulined stacks of deck chairs, vague as smoke your reaching arms, cry that I cannot hear, O voice, The riderless horses still stray before any dawn through the ashy town and face down in the slow waves. Old comrades huddle, stinking in their quilted uniforms. Oh, faultless voice. Well, I think that this... I won't explain how that we have things, stories, several stories being told simultaneously here. My only hope, when people read my poems, my only hope is that readers can see what I am seeing, experience what I am experiencing. I think I was, brought up in the 1960s, or maybe it was 1950s, on those real head-scratching European movies, sort of Antonioni, people like this. You'd wonder what the hell was happening all the time. But I thought, did anyone, I don't know, do you know Alain René's Last Year at Marienbad? It's a movie that most people loathe. I think it's fantastic. It is an amazing movie, and it's influenced me a great deal. And it's more than just a video. But it has the same quality. This is another of these kind of video poems, if you wish. The title is pretentiously in Latin, Non mortuus est amor, Love is not dead. Follow this one, scene by scene. Children at play. As they progress between the hedges, the leaves explode under their naked feet. Their naked calves and buttocks glow in the cold like magnolia petals. The daring of their nudity, each child wears only a black head covering. They move with a forced slowness, bearing in a black hammock the broken baby in a shoebox, its body a fatty yellow. Nothing is more real than this dead one. They make no tracks in the alley. The leaves settle behind them. I left her on the terrace, gazing at the lawns and waterways and shrubs, mirrored beyond her silhouette in a dim window. Inside her open blouse, her fingers scissored her nipple. A string of spittle joined her parted lips. Thus the glass swallowed her, and she entered the sky's grotto. In the heart of the woods, where all alleys meet, the children mount the steps of the shabby gazebo and lay the baby on the mosaic hubstone within the ring of columns. I arrive by a different path to cry with joy that love is not dead. They scatter with shy laughter. Now, this is from my book. A number of other ones are not. I think I'm now going to read the last one from the book, and then the others will be more recent. I think by the time the book represents a lot of years' work here, and towards the end, I got away a little bit from the erotic fantasies that fill out most of the book, and became a little bit more political. Now, for me to be political is a sort of tongue-in-cheek exercise. It's a sort of looking back on the glories of the British Empire and watching American presidents being very imperial and having no right to laugh at anybody, but basically in enjoying the spate of, movies, of all those movies about India that we've seen recently, some of them wonderful, some of them less so. And here's the first of these poems is about an India, of course, I know nothing about except through all the British mythology on which I was brought up. And it's called The Coming of the Rain Stallions. The rain stallions lurch through the gullies of bright granite, but their soft and terrible voices are trapped among the mountains. The sky is quiet out here and pale as fine dust. She shifts her weight in the heavy flounces of her skirt, ivory blonde, resettle and conform once more to the shape of her damp thighs, her shoes assuming a new pattern on the dark stripes of the Derry rug. She, rolling the yellow cigarettes, and they, drawing the tinny bitterness of the tobacco into their lungs to kill the sweet pungency of their white man's clothing. The three of them are at home, at least, with one another. The bamboo sighs. The paddles of the fan stir overhead, and breath after breath, the afternoon turns evening, fetching a hectic blush of tangerine to their languid foreign pallor. For them, the artillery is hauled to the frontier. For them, the last of the grand armadas carries its flickering ensigns over the steel-blue curve of the ocean. For them, the polished torpedoes nudge through sargassos of diplomacy. And for them, the war cry is muttered through properly stiffened lips. As the sun hisses into the undergrowth, the gentlemen lift their gin and grunt, "The Queen!" Eastward, the forgotten peaks are hidden by the black wall of the monsoon. Let's try a fairly recent one here. This one begins with the last words of the score written by Jean Cocteau for Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex. And it's when they're chasing Oedipus out of town. And it's a nice touch. On le chasse avec une extrême douceur. They chase him out with an extreme gentleness. And the poem is called Antigone Behind Locked Doors. And Antigone is the speaker. There are earth movers at work here, Mother. Their hunched silhouettes simplifying the horizon you knew. Yet our days and nights are filled with groaning. In the new gardens, there will still be things, berries or tubers, that husbands will steal to satisfy a craving. I scattered earth for the dead and saw men hurrying home with vegetables pressed to their noisy breasts. All offspring belong to the old one, Mother, to the midwife crone, the giver of guilt. The steam shovels, bulldozers, and backhoes are readying the desert acres for quicksilver rivers, they say. That your grandchildren might smile from their cradle like the sun and moon, your daughter, since her hairs began to spurt, has had to build her nest in a stairless tower in a thicket of roses and has crooned to a starless sky. Brothers will always battle for land. But now the rock is hammered to dust. Night after night that dust is moistened by the dewy dribbles of my dreaming for my dead father-brother, his clumsy gentleness, his brown and blinded hand climbing the rope ladder waterfall of my hair. The old one has shaved me, mother. She has made him lock me in this tomb tower, buried with a boy of straw. The night is airless, but the day leaks in, and the rivers will run, I know. My tears will rinse the dried blood from his empty eyes, and when I have wrapped him in my new-grown hair, he will see me then as once he looked at you. Actually, though, this is a poem about Antigone. I didn't know it was. Actually, it was a poem about Rapunzel. Rapunzel equals Antigone. This is the sort of thing you discover when you write a poem. It's a kind of structuralist approach to everything. It's a weird thing that happens. When you start writing poems, you don't know what is going to equal what until you've got it all worked out. And then suddenly, ah, yes, Rapunzel in her tower, Antigone behind locked doors. At least I say, ah, yes. And maybe two more. What the maps reveal. Again, an epigraph. I don't know why I keep writing epigraphs. It's become a kind of a nod in someone's direction. Whether they illuminate the poems, I'm not sure. This one is from Samuel Beckett. From time immemorial, rumor has it, or better still, the notion is abroad that there exists a way out. What the maps reveal. Via Brigantium, Via Dolorosa. The road goes straight across the continent and ends where a shabby city, shipyards, warehouses, a tangle of railroad tracks, empties itself into the brown and sluggish waves. I was here. Return here in dreams. Carry a bundle of rumpled snapshots, yearbook pictures, postcards addressed to the old comrades, never mailed. I was here, haunting the cathedrals and art collections, coin shops, scouting the cafes for a flash of tit or thigh. But the persons in my old ID cards, bearded or barefaced, are outlanders mostly, foreigners all. It is cheese or olives, or a glass of wine, or a phrase of music, even a single treble voice sustained between high white walls and an azure sky that lets me greet these strangers and lets us huddle over the maps and journals. And the choices not made confront us still. The hordes jostle in daily unease. Above, nervous behind the shining visors of their faith, the pilots rein in their obedient machines. Below, the mothers arrange upon the altar stones the broken remains of their children. The song I hear in the sun-washed alley under the marble battlements is surely Medea holding aloft handfuls of rubies that spill over the cobbles. Medea, the terrorist, the teller of truth that will not be heard except as lovely song and fairy tale. And I am standing again at the sea's edge, the sea wind carrying the cries away over the crumbled concrete, the dark puddles, the charred tree stumps. Here I am, holding my two sons by the hand, at the cost of others, snagged in the tongue-tying thickets of need and custom. At such cost, I do not ask the glittering god of spear and gun and bomb. turning his gaze upon my boys to speak the word and spare them. Well, that's an angry one. And therefore, oh, this is angry too, damn it. Okay. French title, Un permis de séjour dans le Musée de l'Homme. The Musée de l'Homme is an anthropological museum in Paris, and a permis de séjour is a residency permit. And so this is a residency permit in the Museum of Man. And it's really a kind of autobiography, if you will. This isn't working anymore, is it? Is it? Oh, I was yelling just now. I couldn't hear the buzz in my ears. Right. On the first floor, there is matted newspaper left by the flood, dried out now. Nilotic bathing beauties compacted with the undecipherable roster of the war dead, the missing in action, all those whose exploits Homer misheard or misreported. On the second, a sibylline speak your weight machine contemplates the rust-stained urinals and keeps its counsel, while around the tired black Steinway in the deco coliseum of the cocktail lounge, eviscerated sofas sprawl. For a while, I lived on the 12th, leaving when all the drawers were filled with crushed and dusty birds, their plain songs snotted in their nostrils, and trying first the 18th with its leathery library and hurdy-gurdies, and then the 20th. Abandoning there a lifetime's accumulation of books and chairs and shoes, seeking both Lebensraum and quietude. Yes, I have been to the top. I went as high as the staircase goes, to where the concrete walls had broken like biscuits and the girders gave onto smokeless air. Of course, the tower goes higher, like charred bracken fronds on a swealed hillside after a month of rain, twisted I-beams reached into a stratosphere that no longer had anything to say to me or anyone. You too would have hurried down to pore through blank manuscripts, to sway to muted saxophones, to converse with dumb machines. You too would have smiled and smiled, but watching your children sleep would have bitten your lip till it bled. Last poem, I guess it turned out to be the title poem of the volume here, Transit. It's called The Master Teacher in Transit. Master teacher is a sort of concept that teachers have. You want to be a master teacher. It's a thing you try or think you should try to be. The first two words in the poem are the names of a couple of industrial towns in northern France on the border with Belgium. I lived in Belgium for a couple of years before coming to the States, for 4 years before coming to the States, so don't be put off by the strange sound of the names. The Master Teacher in Transit. Roubaix, Tourcoing. The town is of little consequence, save that it is the last station before an arbitrary and undramatic frontier. And of the station itself, I remember only the children. He, sailor-suited, with a bouquet of roses, and his little sister, in red and carrying forget-me-nots, pleasant children, but unsmiling, urged from the grown-up crowd to express their collective greeting. On the train, I lay with my boots up on the dusty upholstery and my head in the nurse's lap. The sky darkened. Rain streaked the windows. She touched my face, smoothing it until there were no eye sockets, no nose, no lips, only the requisite featurelessness on which she could draw the face they would all recognize, scratching in the aristocratic shadow below the cheekbones, inking the benevolent eyes. The deception is professional, an act of love. I have affected the manners of the people, have studied insouciance, spontaneity. To the douanier, there will be nothing to declare. Only the children expect contraband, something ancient to be unwrapped carefully from its dark cloth. I do not know myself what I carry. Maybe it is a curious wind instrument, a flute too fragile now to handle, that played a melody no one now living has heard or could imagine. Maybe it is a piece of yellow skin whose markings may be writings. Maybe it is a shallow bowl of stone filled with blackened kernels, seeds that might, with someone's tears and prayers, be urged to germinate. The children wait, quietly agog. But most will be disappointed. We board the next train to the frontier. My arms filled with their flowers. Thank you.